I am Ann Lynn. I'm an alcoholic. I am really grateful to be here. Thank you so much, Billy, for asking me to speak. You've had a lot of people out to speak at this meeting that I really admire and respect, and so when you asked me, I was like, oh, really just kind of blown away. So thank you, and thank you all for having me. I said my name is Ann Lynn. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is July 10th of 2006. I have a home group and a sponsor, and so just sort of start at the beginning. Sorry, I'm a little nervous, and we'll kind of relax and get into it a little bit. But I didn't start drinking. I started drinking at 16. Before that, I was what I thought was a normal child, aside from like the lying and the manipulating and the incessant need to have my way, I was. I hear people say that they felt awkward and out of place, and like they didn't fit in from the very beginning, and that's not my experience. I was an only child, and that does not make me an alcoholic. And I spent a lot of time by myself. I was very comfortable in my own company. But I spent a lot of time reading books and watching movies. And I always wanted to be living some other life, you know, just something different than where I was. And by the time I got to middle school, which I just blamed on being in middle school, I thought everybody was really uncomfortable and really awkward. But I was so judgmental, and everybody was either below me or above me, and I wanted to be the people who were above me, and I wanted to look down on the people I considered beneath me, and I carried that around up until high school, and I wanted nothing more than to be like the cool girl or the popular girl. Unfortunately, in my high school, I was smart, didn't help. I was in the band, really didn't help, and you know, and so, I mean, I tried a lot of things. I tried church. I tried getting the right boyfriend. And I had an amazing group of girlfriends growing up. I had a couple close ones. But by the time I hit about 16, and I remember it was this beautiful fall night after a Friday night football game, which I was in the marching band. We had performed. And my parents, it was one of the first times they had left me alone in our house. The pool was still open, the trampoline was out, and people were looking for a place to party. And, you know, they talk about opportunity and desire crossing. And I was like, we can have it at my house. And that night, before I had even, I mean, I'd had sips of my parents' drinks. My parents are very normal, very social drinkers. I think my dad, he told stories about his roommate getting drunk in college with just such scorn that, you know, it's still to this day, I'm like, what? But I had never actually been drunk, and I knew that I was just going to get drunk that night. Like, absolutely. There was going to be no, like, easing into it. We were just going to go for it. And I did. And, and I had that reaction to alcohol that people talk about here a lot, is that I felt normal. I felt like I finally felt like other people felt. Like, everybody seemed so happy and comfortable. Like, they didn't have that constant anxiety. And for me, it was like, what are they thinking about me? Do they know that I'm thinking about what they're thinking about me? And the constant aggravation of my head. And alcohol fixed that. And it helped me relax. And it just, I let go. And just everything kind of fell into place. And so I did what every good alcoholic does. We immediately changed game plans. All of a sudden, all of my weekends needed to be drinking. All of a sudden, my friends who went to church were no longer good enough or cool enough or important enough. And I just started lying even more than I had before. And now it was, I really thought that if I kept my grades up and I did what my parents expected of me in certain areas, then I had every right to go and do it exactly what I wanted. I had no cause, I mean, no care, no concern for their well-being, their car that I was driving, their money that I was spending, their house that I was throwing these parties in. You know, all of that seemed irrelevant because I was still on the honor roll, because I had gotten into a good school, you know, because I was still in the band. To me, that was like my trump card. I'm like, I'm in the band. How can I do anything bad? And, you know, I was very good at lying and getting away with stuff. And I had a great time. I mean, drinking did a lot for me. I really felt when it said that you hit that moment and you felt like you had arrived, I really did. Probably not much had changed as far as, like, my social status in school, but I felt better. I felt more important. I felt more special. I felt more a part of. And you know, my drinking was like that. If there was ever, you know, I found reasons to drink early on. If it was like a Wednesday night, I was supposed to be at church, I would go drinking. You know, if I had something, anything was a good reason to party. And I carried that attitude with me to college, where I was bound and determined that I was going to do it right. I didn't have the parents to lie to anymore. I could get away with whatever I wanted. And but I was also a little nervous. New environment, new people. I didn't want to go overboard. You know, you hear these horror stories about going to college parties, and it's just, you know, I was very, very nervous. But the very first night I was there, I was at band camp, and there was an announcement made about a party that was off campus. And they said, this is where we're going to pick up the freshmen, if you would like to come. I was the only girl that showed up to get a ride. And I showed up with bells on. I was so ready to go. And that one night, I still remember, I had two beers. And that was it. And I had a great time at that party. And that was my foray into controlled drinking. That was it. And that was what I clung to. It's like, I can go and have two beers if I want. I have done it before, and I never did it again. But for me, my alcoholism is a progressive disease. And when I got away from any sort of anything that may prevent me from, that might slow me down, you know, I just started bulldozing through things, and I got by my first couple of years because I was smart. The classes weren't really that hard. And gradually my drinking, just the frequency increased. I never really drank more. I couldn't, because I drank till I passed out. Being sick never stopped me. I was just going to keep going. And I started drinking by myself. You know, there would be those random Tuesday nights or Wednesday nights that nobody was doing anything. So you drink by yourself. I didn't think that was odd. My roommates found out, and they did. So we started having parties on Wednesday nights at our house. Problem solved. And I think the turning point for me, I believe that I maybe could have stopped. I mean, I was definitely a heavy drinker, and alcohol definitely did something for me. But I was still able to show up for classes. I was still able to show up for life. You know, I still had friends. And then there was a line I crossed where everything, all of that stuff became irrelevant in the light of taking the next drink. And I went to Greece right before I turned 21. So, like, the 2 weeks prior to my 21st birthday, we were living it up in Greece, me and the marching band, which is about 500 people. And that was where I started drinking in the morning, because I drank so much the night before that to function, to even, like, be able to get on the bus to go somewhere, I would have to drink. It was like ouzo. It was really bad. And I just told myself it was because I was in Greece. You know, I'm on vacation. I'm having fun. This is fun. This is what I want to do. What are you talking about? Please. And I remember one night, my girlfriends and I, we were just going to go to bed early. We were tired. We were very, very tired. And I couldn't. Like, there was something restless in me. And I laid down on that bed, and I tried to go to sleep. I just tried to relax. I just tried to let go. Just drift off. And I couldn't. I had to get out of bed. Sneakily put on some clothes so I couldn't go to the bar in my pajamas, so I could go back down and just get a couple of drinks just to take the edge off so that I could get some sleep. And I didn't want any of the girls that I was staying in the hotel room with to know that I had done that, because we had said we weren't going to drink. And you know, that was one of those moments where I realized I can't not take a drink. And I came back to the States, and I was 21, and any semblance of control or anything was like gone. You know, I didn't have to worry about who was I going to get to buy my liquor. I didn't have to play that game of, like, shuffling the friends around and trying to make like I was buying it for somebody else who needed it. And so my drinking hit a whole new level, and it was morning, noon, and night. I was incapable of living life on life's terms. And I started drinking every day. I tried to hold up the pretense of going to class, and I did okay for that semester. But my grades took a notice. I went from being A's and B's to something like C minuses and D's, which was a big deal for me. It was always my excuse. I'm doing fine. My grades are good. Leave me alone. And I felt like I didn't have that right to say that anymore. So I had to be very protective of my drinking. And I went home that summer and was living with my mom, and she went to put my laundry away and found all of my empty liquor bottles in my dresser drawers. And I got so pissed off at her for putting my laundry away. And that started the string of counselors and therapists and psychologists and psychiatrists, and I had all sorts of symptoms. I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I had already had my first DUI at 20 and when I was at school. And I got a slap on the wrist in community service, had to go to ASAP classes. Everybody gets one, you know. It was just a bad night at the club. The girl I was driving home, she was drunker than I was. I was doing her a favor. And, but something had clicked in my head. You know, and I knew that I was drinking a lot, and I did not want to be an alcoholic. I wanted to be anything other than an alcoholic, because I don't know, I guess it was in ASAP that I had heard about AA, and I didn't want to come here. I'd never been to a meeting in my entire life, but I just knew that it was going to be bad. You know, I just knew that it was just not going to be for me. And the therapist and the psychologist all suggested that I go. And, I made up every excuse in the book. And eventually, I tried to go back to school, and I couldn't do it. I was not very good at hiding how much I was drinking. And I was really trying. And my roommates found me unbearable because I was breaking into their rooms to steal their liquor. Because I was too drunk to drive and get my own, which means I was really drunk. And so I left. I figured, it's Harrisonburg, it's college, it's this environment, it's the pressure. I'm a senior now, the work is too hard, it's too much, I can't cope. So I moved to Europe for a couple of months, to Germany. And, you know, he was going to fix me. He was going to save me. He was going to make everything okay. And he got so tired of me, he shipped me home. And from there, still drinking. Nothing ever made me stop and pause and say, maybe it's the drinking that makes my behavior so horrible or makes my temper so bad or my attitude and my disposition so unbearable that literally people cannot live with me. That never even occurred to me. And if it had, or if it did, it was just like a flash in the pan. There and then gone. And I had a drunken incident and tried to commit suicide, but it wasn't really. I just didn't want to get yelled at again. I was at that point where my mom was tired. I'd moved back in with her. She was tired of my drinking. She'd come home from work because friend of mine knew I was driving drunk that morning, and she came home from work, and I didn't have it in me to hear another lecture, to live through seeing her expression again, and I just wanted something different. And she called the cops. They came, and she lived in a very nice, like, condo area, lots of retired people. This is like 11:30 on a Tuesday, so there are lots of people home, and the cops come, and the police come. And they're dragging me bloody and screaming out the front door, kicking, screaming, yelling horrible things to the cops, to my mother, and they arrest me. You know, and it's only been recently that I actually thought about how that must have made her feel, to have her daughter being carted off in handcuffs again, you know, because they had known about the DUI, and off to the psych ward. And I know they had AA meetings there, but again, I didn't want it to be my drinking. I was willing to be depressed, and I think at one point I had borderline personality disorder, which I don't even know what that is, but I was willing to go with it. I'll take that one. And I got out, and I had just been a week in the psych ward. My parents were desperate for something to work, and I told them that they could not come and pick me up, that I would get a ride home from a friend of mine, and he dropped me off at my house, and with a hospital bracelet still on, still in, like, my dirty pajamas, off to the liquor store I go. You know, there's nothing outside circumstances can do to stop me from drinking. And I was 22 at the time. You know, that was my life for the next 4 years. You know, there's tons of horrifying stories, lots of, you know, incidentally funny ones. But it was just the same sort of gray landscape in front of me. It was just drinking. I tried to go back to school, drank in the parking lot, and could never make it to class. You know, I would have jobs, and I would either drink on the job or never make it to the job, even jobs that I liked. I got my second DUI when I was 25. I was driving up through Prince William County, and I had said some horrible things to my mom. She'd brought up my drinking again. There was crying and disappointment and that incomprehensible demoralization that you feel in the pit of your stomach when someone you love and someone who loves you looks at you and goes, what? Again? Why? What? What can we do? We've taken you to everybody. They've told you, go to AA. I mean, by this point, there was no argument that I was an alcoholic. And I had been to AA meetings and just not interested. You know, I had no desire to have what you guys had. I related. I mean, I knew I was an alcoholic, but I did not care. And, you know, there was nothing there. I just had no willingness. I mean, that was just plain and simple. I was not done yet. And I got that second DUI that night. I remember being on the phone with my father, because he was living in Virginia Beach at the time, and I was living in Richmond with my mom, and saying horrible things to him, saying horrible things to my mother, things that I would never say. That I do not say those things to my parents when I'm sober. I don't even think of them. And hanging up on them. And they don't know what's going on. They don't know where I'm going. They don't know what I'm going to be like when I get there, or if I'm going to get there. And incidentally enough, I did not. I ran into the back of a 17-year-old boy who was newly driving. Luckily, he was in a very large, like, Ford Explorer kind of car. So, gratefully, neither myself nor anybody else was hurt that night. And that's something that I've been blessed with. I mean, I know that I did a lot of drinking and driving, and it was never funny. You know, it was never something that I actually wanted to do. It was just a good time by myself to get some drinking done. And I was arrested, and I went and got in jail and called my daddy. And I was more worried about him fixing things with the boyfriend that I was going to see. I mean, that's how self-centered I was. I had no care or concern. I wanted him to call my boyfriend, because I couldn't call him. I don't know why. But he had to call my boyfriend and fix things with him. Thank you very much, Dad. And can you tell Mom to come and get me tomorrow, too? Oh, my gosh, that was bad. I ended up getting 30 days in jail for that DUI. And I did my time, and my parents were like, yes, this is going to fix her. This is our daughter. She does not go to jail, but now she has been in there. She has seen what it's like, you know, in all of its dirtiness. This will slow her down, stop her. This will change something. Nope. Didn't change a thing. Not at all. And this is just kind of a funny story. You hear people often from the podium say that they stood before the judge and they had the option of jail or rehab. Obviously, you know where I ended up. I had the option of 60 days in rehab or 30 days in jail. And I thought my life was so important and so full of people that I had to get back to it in 30 days. So yes, I am that girl that chose jail over rehab. And when I got out, there was nothing waiting for me. I had no job. I had no friends. I had no boyfriend. I was moving back in with my mom. I had no car. And I still had to drink. The day I got into jail, my parents were determined they were not going to leave me alone. And they made the mistake of leaving me alone for 30, 40 minutes. I called a cab, went to the liquor store, came back. And we were off to the races again. I don't remember much about the next few months. 30 days of enforced sobriety did something. And after that, I got out in May and I got sober in July. I have no clue what happened. I fell down a lot. The minute alcohol entered my system, it was like instantaneous blackout. I was done. I was sitting, it was like a Monday morning, it was about 7:30, or it felt like 7:30 to me. And I was sitting in a therapist's office, and I don't know what it was about that morning, because we had talked about going, shipping me off to rehab, and I was like, no, I can't go. My life is too important here. I mean, self-delusion, I was great at that. And there was something about that morning, you know, and now that I know that I had a moment of grace. Because, I mean, there was no clarity. I wasn't seeing anything, but I just said, fine. You know, maybe it was that I finally saw the despair clearly in my mom's eyes, or maybe I was just done. Maybe I was just tired. And I agreed to go to rehab. I don't know why. I just picked one. It's like, okay, whatever. It's better than my mom kicking me out of the house, because I think she might actually do it this time. I don't have a car to live in, so that's really going to be bad. And I went to rehab. And I would like to say that I went with an open mind and an open heart, really wanting to change. But she's laughing at me because she knows that's so not true. I was like, this is school. This is a project. We're going to get gold stars and good grades here. And I did. But I also heard the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. They were big on the big book. They were big on going to meetings. They were big on having people from outside of the rehab come in and talk about AA and talk about what AA had done for them. And I was like, oh, no. This might actually be where I have to end up. Okay, I'll go to their meetings. But that's it. And that was what I was going to do. I was going to get out. I was going to move back in with my mom. I was going to get the boyfriend back and get a job and go to meetings. And it was going to be fine. Thank you very much. Woman with a plan. My mom would not let me move back in with her. That was unexpected. So I was like, I have to go to Northern Virginia. And they found me a house, a sober house, with women, which I wasn't really thrilled with either. And they said, you had to go to 5 meetings a week and you can't drink or you're going to get kicked out in like 30 minutes. And that kind of scared me. Homelessness actually did scare me. And so I moved into this sober house in Arlington. And I had about 32 days sober. And I really had nothing better to do with my time. Like, I had nothing going on. I mean, it was... I think back now, and I thought I was doing fine. I was not. I was hopeless and helpless, and I didn't know anybody. I didn't know what to do. So I went to meetings across the street at the hospital, and I believe that going to meetings is better than not going to meetings because it bought me time. You know, I didn't listen. I didn't get numbers. I didn't raise my hand to share. I didn't say, hi, I'm new. Can you help me? I sat there like a lump on the log and took up their air. But I was presented with an opportunity to get the life that I thought I wanted back. The boy called. He said, let's go to Florida. I'm going to pick you up over the weekend, and we're going to go. And I wasn't allowed to leave. And this is, I believe... In retrospect, obviously, I didn't know it at the time, but this was the turning point for me in my sobriety, and it's only attributable to God, to my higher power, because that was what I wanted. I mean, that was what I had gotten sober to do, was to get him back. And I got out my suitcase, I even started packing. And then I went to a meeting. And I sent him an email later that night saying, I can't go. I'm going to stay here. And at the time, I really thought that that was my decision. I thought that it was me, and I thought that it was some great thing that I was doing. No, I've come to believe that it is my higher power looking out for me and doing for me what I could not do for myself. And that was the only even slightly right action I took during the first 3 months of my sobriety, because outside of like that one moment, I was lying, cheating, manipulating, living like an alcoholic, but without the alcohol to like ease the guilt and the remorse and the shame. So I was a mess. And at about 3 months sober, I was out of options, out of ideas, and just really, really miserable. And another moment of grace. And I got a phone number of one woman in AA. And I called her, and she listened to the crazy newcomer story, you know, you get, and she's crying, and, you know, boyfriend's gone, and I don't have a job, and I don't have any money, and I don't have a car, and my life is horrible, you know, all of the drama. And she's like, well, do you go to meetings? And I explained my situation, and she was like, okay, I'm going to pick you up and take you to a meeting where I go, and there's lots of young people. Okay, whatever. I'll get in the car. And from that night, my life changed. I fell in with an amazing group of active young people in AA who had sponsors, who were working the steps, who were busy, and they had lives, and they looked happy and successful. And they did stuff. You know, I just sat. And usually I didn't even sit. I kind of laid down. And they were so attractive. And for the first time, I looked around Alcoholics Anonymous. And I saw people who had something I wanted. You know, I wanted what they had. This joy and this comfort and this excitement. And so I started getting into people's cars. That was it. That was the foundation of my new sobriety. It was just getting in the car and going. And I wasn't big on calling people, so people called me all the time. That is another amazing gift of AA, is that I didn't have to do a whole lot. They just swept me up and carried me along until I was able to do the same for somebody else. And I thought I had my stuff together. I really did think that I was newly sober and sane. But thank God I got a sponsor. I got so tired of people asking me who's my sponsor. So I asked this girl who had been incessantly picking me up. She was a student in college. I had dropped out of two colleges. So I was like, hey, she's got something I want. I'll ask her. And she started reading the Big Book with me. And she started holding me accountable. I had to call her every day. I didn't know why. I didn't have a whole lot to say. But it was the beginning of forming a partnership with somebody. The beginning of forming a relationship with somebody that had been so long since I had had any sort of, like, contact, like, actual connection with another human being. I didn't realize how hungry I was for it. You know, I was torn between wanting to go out and be with all of these people and then wanting to just be left alone. But I didn't have a car. And that was another one of my saving graces. I couldn't drive. So people came and picked me up, and I went, and I got involved in service and hanging out and the fellowship. And my life changed. I mean, it changed drastically, very quickly. The women I lived with, I remember one of them who turned out to be one of my best friends. She looked at me across the dinner table one night. I'd been saying something. And she looked at me and she goes, wow, you do talk. Because I had spent like months, just the only things out of my mouth were like usually sarcastic, smart aleck comments about something. You know, ray of light to be around. And, you know, I was excited to be going to meetings. And I started going to meetings every night. More, and I was like, but the hospital requires me to go to 5. And my sponsor was like, but I go to 7. I'm like, okay. So, and I started getting service, and I learned the hard way about having to show up for service, because there were a couple times when I couldn't get out of the house, and I wasn't able to show up for service, and I started to feel guilty about that, and I started to feel like, wow, that I feel like a part of that meeting. I feel like I need to be there. And I never had that. It was like I couldn't care less whether I showed up or didn't. And most importantly, my sponsor sat down and we started going through the big book. And she helped me to find myself. Because I had read the big book so drunk. And I thought I had understood it just fine. I was like, yeah, I relate. I'm an alcoholic. Of course I'm in there somewhere. But she sat me down and we started going through the steps. And I had seen the steps. I had read the steps. We talked about them in rehab. And I picked out the ones I was willing to do. The ones I had already done. And the ones that we just weren't going to talk about. And she was like, well, we'll start at step one. Which is a very good place to start. I had come to believe that I was an alcoholic. I knew that before I had even gotten sober. But for me, the idea of my life being unmanageable was just really difficult to swallow. You know, even my outside circumstances were unmanageable. I mean, I had no money. I was living in a group sober house. I just came out of rehab after coming out of jail. You know, really not shining examples of manageability in my life, but I thought I was doing just fine. You know, my ego and my pride were like, you know what, just need a little time, get your feet under you, and you'll be fine, and you can take care of yourself, and get yourself into this situation, and get yourself out of it. You know, it was all about what I could do to fix my own life, and my sponsor had me sit down and write out instances where I was powerless or radical. That was easy. And then I had to write down where my life was unmanageable, And that was a little more difficult. I actually had to look up manageable in a dictionary. Actually, I think I've looked up manageable and then took all the opposites of it. And for the first time in my life, I actually sat down and tried to look and tried to see where my life was unmanageable. Because I wanted my sponsor to think I was doing a good job. I mean, that was my great motivation for doing step work in the beginning, was I really wanted her to like me and think I was good student. But I saw clearly on paper that it's not just my bills that aren't being paid. It's just not the jail and the chaos that my life turned into. But it was my inability to be a friend. It was my inability to make any sort of decision that didn't cause the chaos and destruction in the lives of people around me. You know, I was incapable of doing anything but drinking. And all of my decisions were based on my self-interest in getting a drink. And for me, that leads to unmanageable relationships, that leads to unmanageable everything. And that was pretty significant for me. You know, I'd never really thought about it. I'd never really thought about the other people in my life. You know, they were just there. And I didn't think I needed a second and third step. I figured I'd been to church, been baptized, been confirmed. I believed in God. He's fine. I'm good. You know, I thought that you had a relationship with a higher power if you, like, did foxhole prayers. And I prided myself. The nights I got arrested, never prayed. I never said, God, if you get me out of this, I'll change. I never, like, got so sick. But I said, God, if you just make this go away, I swear I'll stop drinking. You know, and I prided myself on that. I figured God was doing his thing, I was doing my thing. And never the twain shall meet. But with the help of my sponsor, the help of meetings, and watching other people have relationships with their higher power, and listening to people talk about their relationships with their higher power, you know, I thought it was odd how everybody seemed to talk about God as if he was doing something in their lives. And that just fascinated me. And my sponsor said that I could have that too. And I just was like, okay. And I remember, I had to do some writing on the third step, and then it was New Year's Eve, and it was a Sunday night that was New Year's Eve. It was my first New Year sober. And we were in the church after the meeting, our Sunday night home group meeting. We were up in the balcony, and we got down on our knees and said the third step prayer right there. And I was like, okay, cool, moving on. You know, it didn't have a whole lot of resonance right then in that moment, except it planted the idea that God maybe could be a little bit more personal. You know, and she told me to start praying every day and every night. And she said, let's get started on your 4 step. I said, okay. And I didn't pray every day and every night. I prayed on occasion when I thought she would ask me about it. And I didn't start working on my 4 step until like a month and a half later. We were in California and I was there. She was there. I was supposed to be working on it. And they caught me napping. So I managed to get it done very quickly after that. They could see what I was constructive use of my 4 step time. And for me, my 3rd step at the time was just about being, I was willing to listen to somebody else, and she said, you have to do this. And you have to put all of this down on paper. And I did. I wrote a 4 step. I wrote Ann Lynn's 4 step that Ann Lynn wanted her sponsor to hear, because I knew what was coming. I wanted her to know my story, the poor put upon Ann Lynn, and there's that 4th column. And I think I just copied down, like, fear a lot from the book. I just sort of wrote down the words from the book. But then when we got to our 5th step, for every resentment, my sponsor asked the same question. So what was your part? And we sat there, and I didn't have, like, 300 resentments. I had several, many. But for everyone, we went through what my part was. And for the first time, I was like, wow, I am not the victim here. This, my life is my doing. Even in situations I really thought I was blameless, like, really held on to that. I wasn't. I always had something to do with it. And my character defects started becoming very apparent. But, you know, we came to the end of that 5th step and that question. It's like, is there anything else you need to tell me? You know, is there anything that you would like to add? And I looked my sponsor dead in the eye, and I lied and I said no. Because there was something that I was lying in sobriety, and it was stupid to say. I lied and said I'd graduated from college. And because I don't even know why. For whatever reason. And that would have been a great time to tell my sponsor, oh, by the way, the last 6-7 months I've been lying to you, you know, this education I have. Not really so much. But I didn't. You know, it's my pride, my ego. And I was perfectly willing to look at all this, the insanity that was my drinking. You know, because there was always the cloud of drinking over it. When you start doing that stuff in sobriety, it's a little harder to be like, wow, that's just me. I really am just that dishonest. I really am that prideful. My ego really is that big. Despite what I want everybody to think, you know, my behavior obviously points to the contrary. And I held on to that. I held on to that for several more months. And it was literally my sponsor and my grand sponsor were pushing me to go to law school. I was trying to figure out a way to go to law school without actually having an undergrad degree. And my sponsor was leaving for Spain, and I don't know, something, another moment of grace for me. And I just told my sponsor. And it was no big deal. Like, all of this time, it was no big deal. And I'm happy to say that with the help of my sponsor, I did go back to school. I actually have a legitimate undergrad degree now. Which I would never have done on my own. Like, the plans I had to go back to school on my own, I mean, it's just one small example of, like, I come up with these great plans, but they're, like, all in secret. I have no one to hold me accountable for these, like, deadlines that came and went while I was doing all of this planning. But the minute I opened my mouth and got honest, help arrived, I went through the process, and, you know, it happened. You know, I was able to show up because and people holding me accountable and saying, are you supposed to be in class? You know, or if I showed up somewhere and they're like, you need to be somewhere else. And, you know, and for me, you know, my relationship with my sponsor, you know, it's been a constant evolution. But it has, you know, it starts with me being honest. And, you know, that's been one of the hardest things for me to let go of, is because I want to control what you think of me. you know, I want you to have the information about me that I think that you should. And that way, I know what you're thinking. And, you know, and that's so much of my own ego getting in my own way. And whenever I can let that go and let that down and just be honest, amazing things happen. Amazing, amazing things happen. And I made a list of my character defects and sort of checked the box on 6 and 7 on my first time through. I didn't really know what to do with them. So I did the work that my sponsor asked me to do. I said the prayer. And I was like, okay, moving on. And we went right on into my 8th and 9th step. And you can tell from my story that I had really horrible relationships with my parents when I had first gotten sober. They, I feel like, were amazing, amazing people with amazing spirits, because I got sober and they sort of let everything go, which just goes to show that they're probably not alcoholic, because I would have carried that with me for a long time. And, but I got to make formal amends. My sponsor, as soon as I got her, had me start changing the way I was interacting with my parents, and had me change the way I started behaving when I was around my parents. But I was able to sit down with both my mother and my father separately and make formal amends and address in a general way, you know, the kind of daughter that I was. And honestly look them in the eye and say, you know what, I'm changing. And this is the way that I'm going to be a better daughter for you. And say that with the knowledge that I had the help to help me do that. That if I stayed here and did and worked the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and kept this at the forefront of my life, that I did not have to go and worry about my behavior again. That I could actually keep my word. And so far, I have been able to be a daughter that my parents are proud of. I've been able to show up for my family, even when I feel like it's not very convenient, but I show up. And I try to be helpful. You know, I call, and I have amazing relationships with all of the members of my family. And my grandfather actually passed away before I was able to make amends to him. And I struggled with that for a while, because I didn't really see a lot of my part in his. And, you know, my sponsor was amazing, and I would not have been able to get through this without her. And I was able to drive down with a girlfriend and make amends with him at his grave. And I really didn't think that it would have such an impact, but it did. You know, I felt something shift inside of me that day. And being able to, I think, to continue to make amends. I mean, my amends to him is that I treat the family that he loved with the love and respect that they deserve, and be able to keep that word to my grandfather. It's been an amazing gift. And I can't believe your hours going. But, you know, now, you know, I'm still working. I still have lots of amends to make. And, you know, and now for me, it's not so much about, like, you know, when I was newly sober, it was about, like, the moment is, like, the 4th step and getting your 5th step done. And now for me, it's very much a part of, like, what am I doing to help another alcoholic? How is my 12th step? How are my affairs? How are my principles in all of my affairs? You know, what am I doing to help another alcoholic? When I call my sponsor, have I taken a look at myself? Have I looked at my behavior? Have I looked at my motives? Have I been honest? And in the morning and at night, where I struggled so long, with getting down on my knees, in the morning and at night, am I praying? Am I remembering to bring God into my life throughout my day? Because I need him. And I am certainly not very good at it. I definitely get in places where I think that it is my idea, my plan, my life, all of the wonderful things that have happened in the last 3 years are a result of what I've done. And that's so far from the truth. You know, it has been Alcoholics Anonymous, the people here who have introduced me to a higher power and have encouraged me and showed me how to develop a relationship with a God that I don't really understand, but I believe in anyways, that has been what's worked in my life. You know, none of my ideas work out unless they happen to be the same idea that my sponsor has, and that's usually just a coincidence. You know, and that's sometimes very hard for me to remember. You know, God bless my sponsor, because I know that I feel like it's just like this wave. Like sometimes I'm like really like on point, and I'm like listening, and it's amazing when I'm taking the action, taking my 10 step, praying, meditating, helping out the alcoholics. I feel very connected with my sponsor. I feel very connected with my higher power. I feel very connected with all of you. And when those things start to slip, I mean, they don't call them maintenance steps for nothing. You know, the walls start coming up. You know, all of a sudden, I becomes a much bigger word in my vocabulary. You know, I need to, I want to, I have to, becomes a lot more important. And it gets really uncomfortable. I hate to say it, that it's been 3 years sober before I finally have gotten to a place where we're not taking, for me, it's always not taking the actions here, has gotten uncomfortable. You know, and now it's like, I am like on a mission. I am like, I am going to find every alcoholic I can possibly help and see if I can at least get their number. And, you know, I feel like somebody's lit a fire under me. You know, I'm more interested in helping other people than I have ever been. And I used to pray, because, you know, I like sponsoring people. I have sponsored people in the past. They didn't stick, but it's still worth it. And but I thought that was like the be-all, end-all of love and service. And, you know, I learned that just reaching out your hand to any alcoholic, just to any, to my fellow man, is a way of being of love and service. And that is what brings me the peace and the comfort and the serenity that I first saw in all of you guys. Because the people in Alcoholics Anonymous that I met when I first started coming around were doing that. They didn't care if I had a sponsor. They didn't care that I didn't want one. They were just, hey, can I get your number? Hey, can I call you? Hey, can I give you a ride? And that's the kind of attitude that I need to take and have to take if I'm gonna stay here. And I will close with this, and that you know, every I hear people say this all the time, that everything good in my life is a result of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that is so true for me. And I did not want to find my life here. I wanted anything other than Alcoholics Anonymous to work for me. I thought it was like a team project or something that, I don't know, some like laborious task that I would have to do. I mean, I just saw myself getting involved in this and getting dragged down into like this, I don't even know what. It was not good. And it's been the exact opposite. I have found more joy, more laughter, more love, more fun in these rooms with people who are busy living. And you know, and that's what I wanna present to the new alcoholic, or to the new person in the room tonight, is that this is not about gray and dreary days of, well, it's not a basement, but, you know, just spending churches. You know, this is 1 hour in an AA meeting. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous is part of my life, the other 23, and for me, that's where that's what I need to remember, because it's where my joy is. And when I remember that, you know, I am joyous, I'm happy, I'm free. And thank you so much, Billy, for asking me to speak, and thank you for letting me share.